A Place Called Freedom by Ken Follett, read by Sean Barrett. I did a lot of gardening when I first moved into High Glen House, and that's how I found the iron collar. The house was falling down and the garden was overgrown. A crazy old lady had lived there for 20 years and never given it a lick of paint. She died and I bought it from her son, who owns the Toyota dealership in Kirkburn, the nearest town, 50 miles away. You might wonder why a person would buy a dilapidated house 50 miles from nowhere. But I just love this valley. There are shy deer in the woods and an eagle's nest right at the top of the ridge. Out in the garden, I would spend half the time leaning on my spade and staring at the blue-green mountainsides. But I did some digging, too. I decided to plant some shrubs around the outhouse. It's not a handsome building, clapboard walls with no windows, and I wanted to screen it with bushes. While I was digging the trench, I found a box. It wasn't very big, about the size of those cases that contain 12 bottles of good wine. It wasn't fancy either, just plain unvarnished wood held together with rusty nails. I broke it open with the blade of my spade. There were 2 things inside. One was a big old book. I got quite excited at that. Perhaps it was a family Bible with an intriguing history written on the flyleaf. The births, marriages, and deaths of people who had lived in my house 100 years ago. But I was disappointed. When I opened it, I found that the papers had turned to pulp. Not a word could be read. The other item was an oilcloth bag. That, too, was rotten, and when I touched it with my gardening gloves, it disintegrated. Inside was an iron ring about 6 inches across. It was tarnished, but the oilcloth bag had prevented it from rusting away. It looked crudely made, probably by a village blacksmith, and at first I thought it might have been part of a cart or a plough. But why had someone wrapped it carefully in oilcloth to preserve it? There was a break in the ring, and it had been bent. I began to think of it as a collar that some prisoner had been forced to wear. When the prisoner escaped, the ring had been broken with a heavy blacksmith's tool and then bent to get it off. I took it in the house and started to clean it up. It was slow work, so I steeped it in rust away overnight, then tried again in the morning. As I polished it with a rag, an inscription became visible. It was engraved in old-fashioned curly writing, and it took me a while to figure it out. But this is what it said. This man is the property of Sir George Jamieson of Fife, A.D. 1767. It's here on my desk, beside the computer. I use it as a paperweight. I often pick it up and turn it in my hands, rereading that inscription. If the iron collar could talk, I think to myself, what kind of story would it tell? Part 1. Scotland. Chapter 1. Snow crowned the ridges of High Glen and lay on the wooded slopes in pearly patches, like jewellery on the bosom of a green silk dress. In the valley bottom, a hasty stream dodged between icy rocks. The bitter wind that howled inland from the North Sea brought flurries of sleet and hail. Walking to church in the morning, the McCash twins, Malachy and Esther, followed a zigzag trail along the eastern slope of the glen. Malachy, known as Mac, wore a plaid cape and tweed breeches, but his legs were bare below the knee, and his feet, without stockings, froze in his wooden clogs. However, he was young and hot-blooded, and he hardly noticed the cold. This was not the shortest way to church, but High Glen always thrilled him. The high mountainsides, the quiet, mysterious woods, and the laughing water formed a landscape familiar to his soul. He had watched a pair of eagles raise 3 sets of nestlings here. Like the eagles, he had stolen the laird salmon from the teeming stream, and, like the deer, he had hidden in the trees, silent and still, when the gamekeepers came. The laird was a woman, Lady Hallam, a widow with a daughter. The land on the far side of the mountain belonged to Sir George Jamieson, and it was a different world. Engineers had torn great holes in the mountainsides. Man-made hills of slag disfigured the valley. Massive wagons loaded with coal ploughed the muddy road, and the stream was black with dust. There the twins lived, in a village called Hugh, a long row of low stone houses marching uphill like a staircase. They were male and female versions of the same image. Both had fair hair, blackened by coal dust, and striking pale green eyes. Both were short and broad-backed, with strongly muscled arms and legs. Both were opinionated and argumentative. Arguments were a family tradition. Their father had been an all-round nonconformist, eager to disagree with the government, the church, or any other authority. Their mother had worked for Lady Hallam before her marriage, and like many servants, she identified with the upper class. One bitter winter, when the pit had closed for a month after an explosion, father had died of the black spit, the cough that killed so many coal miners, and mother got pneumonia and followed him within a few weeks. But the arguments went on, usually on Saturday nights in Mrs. Wheel's parlour, the nearest thing to a tavern in the village of Hugh. The estate workers and the crofters took mother's view. They said the king was appointed by God, and that was why people had to obey him. The coal miners had heard newer ideas. John Locke and other philosophers said a government's authority could come only from the consent of the people. This theory appealed to Mac. Few miners in Hugh could read, but Mac's mother could, and he had pestered her to teach him. She had taught both her children, ignoring the jibes of her husband, who said she had ideas above her station. At Mrs. Wheel's, Mac was called on to read aloud from The Times, The Edinburgh Advertiser, and political journals such as the radical North Britain. The papers were always weeks out of date, sometimes months, but the men and women of the village listened avidly to long speeches reported verbatim, satirical diatribes, and accounts of strikes, protests, and riots. It was after a Saturday night argument at Mrs. Wheel's that Mac had written the letter. None of the miners had ever written a letter before, and there had been long consultations about every word. It was addressed to Caspar Gordonson, a London lawyer who wrote articles in the journals ridiculing the government. The letter had been entrusted to Davy Patch, the one-eyed peddler, for posting, and Mac had wondered if it would ever reach its destination. The reply had come yesterday, and it was the most exciting thing that had ever happened to Mac. It would change his life beyond recognition, he thought. It might set him free. As far back as he could remember, he had longed to be free. As a child, he had envied Davy Patch, who roamed from village to village selling knives and string and ballads. What was so wonderful about Davy's life, to the child Mac, was that he could get up at sunrise and go to sleep when he felt tired. Mac, from the age of 7, had been shaken awake by his mother a few minutes before 2 o'clock in the morning, and had worked down the mine for 15 hours, finishing at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, then had staggered home, often to fall asleep over his evening porridge. Mac no longer wanted to be a peddler, but he still yearned for a different life. He dreamed of building a house for himself, in a valley like High Glen, on a piece of land he could call his own. Of working from dawn to dusk and resting all the hours of darkness. Of the freedom to go fishing on a sunny day, in a place where the salmon belonged not to the laird, but to whoever caught them. And the letter in his hand meant that his dreams might come true.
"I'm still not sure you should read it aloud in church," Esther said as they tramped across the frozen mountainside.
Mac was not sure either, but he said,
"Why not? There'll be trouble. Ratchet will be furious."
Harry Ratchet was the viewer, the man who managed the mine on behalf of the owner.
"He might even tell Sir George, and then what will they do to you?"
He knew she was right, and his heart was full of trepidation, but that did not stop him arguing with her.
"If I keep the letter to myself, it's pointless," he said. "Well, you could show it to Ratchet privately. He might let you leave quietly, without any fuss."
Mac glanced at his twin out of the corner of his eye. She was not in a dogmatic frame of mind, he could tell. She looked troubled rather than combative. He felt a surge of affection for her. Whatever happened, she would be on his side. All the same, he shook his head stubbornly.
"I'm not the only one affected by this letter. There's at least 5 lads would want to get away from here if they knew they could. And what about future generations?"
She gave him a shrewd look.
"You may be right, but that's not the real reason. You want to stand up in church and prove the mine owner wrong."
"No, I don't,"
Mac protested. Then he thought for a moment and grinned.
"Well, there may be something in what you say. We've heard so many sermons about obeying the law and respecting our betters. Now we find that they've been lying to us all along about the one law that affects us most. Of course I want to stand up and shout it aloud."
"Don't give them a reason to punish you," she said worriedly.
He tried to reassure her.
I'll be as polite and humble as can be, he said. You'll hardly recognize me. Humble, she said skeptically. I'd like to see that. I'm just going to say what the law is. How can that be wrong? It's incautious.
Aye, that it is, he conceded. But I'm going to do it anyway.
They crossed a ridge and dropped down the far side, back into Coalpit Glen. As they descended, the air became a little less cold. A few moments later, the small stone church came into view, beside a bridge over the dirty river. Near the churchyard clustered a few crofters' hovels. These were round huts, with an open fire in the middle of the earth floor and a hole in the roof to let the smoke out, the one room shared by cattle and people all winter. The miners' houses, farther up the glen near the pits, were better. Though they too had earth floors and turf roofs, everyone had a fireplace and a proper chimney and glass in the little window by the door. And miners were not obliged to share their space with cows. All the same, the crofters considered themselves free and independent and looked down on the miners. However, it was not the peasants' huts that now arrested the attention of Mac and Esther and brought them up short. A closed carriage with a fine pair of greys in harness stood at the church porch. Several ladies in hooped skirts and fur wraps were getting out, helped by the pastor, holding on to their fashionable lacy hats. Esther touched Mac's arm and pointed to the bridge. Riding across on a big chestnut hunter, his head bent into the cold wind, was the owner of the mine, the laird of the glen, Sir George Jamieson. Jamieson had not been seen here for 5 years. He lived in London, which was a week's journey by ship, 2 weeks by stagecoach. He had once been a penny-pinching Edinburgh chandler, people said, selling candles and gin from a corner shop, and no more honest than he had to be. Then a relative had died young and childless, and George had inherited the castle and the mines. On that foundation he had built a business empire that stretched to such unimaginably distant places as Barbados and Virginia. And he was now starchily respectable, a baronet, a magistrate, and alderman of Wapping, responsible for law and order along London's waterfront. He was obviously paying a visit to his Scottish estate, accompanied by family and guests.
"Well, that's that," Esther said with relief.
"What do you mean?"
said Mac, although he could guess.
"You won't be able to read out your letter now."
"Why not?"
"Malachy MacCash, don't be a damn fool," she exclaimed. "Not in front of the laird himself."
"On the contrary," he said stubbornly. "This makes it all the better."
Chapter 2. Lizzie Hallam refused to go to church in the carriage. It was a silly idea. The road from Jamieson Castle was a rutted, potholed track, its muddy ridges frozen as hard as rock. The ride would be frightfully bumpy, the carriage would have to go at walking pace, and the passengers would arrive cold and bruised and probably late. She insisted on riding to church. Such unladylike behaviour made her mother despair.
"How will you ever get a husband if you always act like a man?" Lady Hallam said.
"I can get a husband whenever I like," Lizzie replied.
It was true. Men fell in love with her all the time.
"The problem is finding one I can put up with for more than half an hour."
"The problem is finding one that doesn't scare easily," her mother muttered.
Lizzie laughed. They were both right. Men fell in love with her at first sight, then found out what she was like and backed off hurriedly. Her comments had scandalized Edinburgh society for years. At her first ball, talking to a trio of old dowagers, she had remarked that the High Sheriff had a fat backside, and her reputation had never recovered. Last year, Mother had taken her to London in the spring and launched her into English society. It had been a disaster. Lizzie had talked too loud, laughed too much, and openly mocked the elaborate manners and tight clothes of the dandified young men who tried to court her.
"It's because you grew up without a man in the house," her mother added. "It's made you too independent."
With that, she got into the carriage. Lizzie walked across the flinty front of Jamieson Castle, heading for the stables on the east side. Her father had died when she was 3, so she hardly remembered him. When she asked what killed him, her mother said vaguely,
"Liver."
He had left them penniless. For years, Mother had scraped by, mortgaging more and more of the Hallam estate, waiting for Lizzie to grow up and marry a wealthy man who would solve all their problems. Now Lizzie was 20 years old,
and it was time to fulfill her destiny. That was undoubtedly why the Jamieson family were visiting their Scottish property again after all these years, and why their principal house guests were their neighbours, Lizzie and her mother, who lived only 10 miles away. The pretext for the party was the 21st birthday of the younger son, Jay. But the real reason was that they wanted Lizzie to marry the older son, Robert. Mother was in favour, as Robert was the heir to a great fortune. Sir George was in favour because he wanted to add the Hallam estate to the Jamieson family's land. Robert seemed to be in favour, to judge by the way he had been paying attention to her ever since they arrived, although it was always hard to know what was in Robert's heart. She saw him standing in the stable yard, waiting for the horses to be saddled. He resembled the portrait of his mother that hung in the castle hall, a grave, plain woman with fine hair and light eyes, and a determined look about the mouth. There was nothing wrong with him. He was not especially ugly, neither thin nor fat, nor did he smell bad, or drink too much, or dress effeminately. He was a great catch, Lizzie told herself, and if he proposed marriage, she would probably accept. She was not in love with him, but she knew her duty. She decided to banter with him a little. "It really is most inconsiderate of you to live in London," she said. "Inconsiderate?" he frowned. "Why?" "You leave us without neighbours." Still he looked puzzled. It seemed he did not have much of a sense of humour. She explained, "With you away, there isn't another soul between here and Edinburgh." A voice behind her said, "Apart from 100 families of coal miners and several villages of crofters." "You know what I mean," she said, turning. The man who had spoken was a stranger to her. With her usual directness, she said, "Anyway, who are you?" "Jay Jamieson," he said with a bow. "Robert's cleverer brother." "How could you forget?" "Oh." She had heard he had arrived late last night, but she had not recognized him. 5 years ago, he had been several inches shorter, with pimples on his forehead and a few soft blonde hairs on his chin. He was handsomer now, but he had not been clever then, and she doubted if he had changed in that respect.
"I remember you," she said. "I recognize the conceit."
He grinned.
"If only I'd had your example of humility and self-effacement to copy, Miss Hallam."
Robert said, "Hello, Jay. Welcome to Castle Jamieson." Jay looked suddenly sulky.
"Drop the proprietorial air, Robert. You may be the elder son, but you haven't inherited the place yet."
Lizzie intervened, saying,
"Congratulations on your 21st birthday."
"Thank you."
"Is it today?"
"Yes," Robert said impatiently. "Are you going to ride to church with us?" Lizzie saw hatred in Jay's eyes, but his voice was neutral.
"Yes, I've told them to saddle a horse for me."
"We'd better get going." Robert turned toward the stable and raised his voice. "Hurry up in there!"
"All set, sir,"
a groom called from within, and a moment later 3 horses were led out, a sturdy black pony, a light bay mare, and a grey gelding.
Jay said, "I suppose these beasts must have been hired from some Edinburgh horse dealer."
His tone was critical, but he went to the gelding and patted its neck, letting it nuzzle his blue riding coat. Lizzie saw that he was comfortable with horses and fond of them. She mounted the black pony, riding side saddle, and trotted out of the yard. The brothers followed, Jay on the gelding and Robert on the mare. The wind blew sleet into Lizzie's eyes. Snow underfoot made the road treacherous, for it hid potholes a foot or more deep that caused the horses to stumble.
Lizzie said, "Let's ride through the woods. It will be sheltered, and the ground is not so uneven."
Without waiting for agreement, she turned her horse off the road and into the ancient forest. Underneath the tall pines, the forest floor was clear of bushes. Streamlets and marshy patches were frozen hard, and the ground was dusted white. Lizzie urged her pony into a canter. After a moment, the grey horse passed her. She glanced up and saw a challenging grin on Jay's face. He wanted to race. She gave a whoop and kicked the pony, who sprang forward eagerly. They dashed through the trees, ducking under low boughs, jumping over fallen trunks, and splashing heedlessly through streams. Jay's horse was bigger and would have been faster in a gallop, but the pony's short legs and light frame were better adapted to this terrain, and gradually Lizzie pulled ahead. When she could no longer hear Jay's horse, she slowed down and came to a standstill in a clearing. Jay soon caught up, but there was no sign of Robert. Lizzie guessed he was too sensible to risk his neck in a pointless race. She and Jay walked on, side by side, catching their breath. Heat rose from the horses, keeping the riders warm.
"I'd like to race you on the straight," Jay panted. "Riding astride, I'd beat you," she said.
He looked a little shocked. All well-bred women rode side-saddle. For a woman to ride astride was considered vulgar. Lizzie thought that was a silly idea, and when she was alone she rode like a man. She studied Jay out of the corner of her eye. His mother, Alicia, Sir George's second wife, was a fair-haired coquette, and Jay had her blue eyes and winning smile.
"What do you do in London?"
Lizzie asked him.
"I'm in the 3rd Regiment of Foot Guards."
A note of pride came into his voice, and he added,
"I've just been made a captain."
"Well, Captain Jamieson, what do you brave soldiers have to do?" she said mockingly. "Is there a war in London at the moment? Any enemies for you to kill?"
"There's plenty to do, keeping the mob under control."
Lizzie suddenly remembered Jay as a mean, bullying child, and she wondered if he enjoyed his work.
"And how do you control them?" she asked. "For example, by escorting criminals to the gallows and making sure they don't get rescued by their cronies before the hangman does his work?"
"So you spend your time killing Englishmen, like a true Scots hero?" He did not seem to mind being teased.
"One day I'd like to resign my commission and go abroad," he said.
"Oh? Why?"
"No one takes any notice of a younger son in this country. Even servants stop and think about it when you give them an order."
"And you believe it will be different elsewhere?"
"Everything is different in the colonies. I've read books about it. People are more free and easy. You're taken for what you are."
"What would you do?"
"My family has a sugar plantation in Barbados. I'm hoping my father will give it to me for my 21st birthday, as my portion, so to speak."
Lizzie felt deeply envious.
"Lucky you," she said. "There's nothing I'd like more than to go to a new country. How thrilling it would be."
"It's a rough life out there," he said. "You might miss the comforts of home, shops and operas and French fashions and so on."
"I don't care for any of that," she said contemptuously. "I hate these clothes."
She was wearing a hooped skirt and a tight-waisted corset.
"I'd like to dress like a man in breeches and shirt and riding boots."
He laughed.
"That might be going a bit far, even in Barbados."
Lizzie was thinking, "Now if Robert would take me to Barbados, I'd marry him like a shot."
"And you have slaves to do all the work," Jay added.
They emerged from the forest a few yards upstream from the bridge. On the other side of the water, the miners were filing into the little church. Lizzie was still thinking about Barbados.
"It must be very odd to own slaves and be able to do anything you like to them, as if they were beasts," she said. "Doesn't it make you feel strange?"
"Not in the least," Jay said with a smile. Chapter 3. The little church was full. The Jamieson family and their guests took up a great deal of room, the women with their wide skirts and the men with their swords and three-cornered hats. The miners and crofters, who formed the usual Sunday congregation, left a space around the newcomers, as if afraid they might touch the fine clothes and besmirch them with coal dust and cow dung. Mac had spoken defiantly to Esther, but he was full of apprehension. Coal owners had the right to flog miners, and on top of that, Sir George Jamieson was a magistrate, which meant he could order someone hanged, and there would be no one to contradict him. It was indeed foolhardy for Mac to risk the wrath of such a powerful man. But right was right. Mac and the other miners were being treated unjustly, illegally, and every time he thought of it, he felt so angry he wanted to shout it from the rooftops. He could not spread the news surreptitiously, as if it might not really be true. He had to be bold or back out. For a moment, he considered backing out. Why make trouble? Then the hymn began, and the miners sang in harmony, filling the church with their thrilling voices. Behind him, Mac heard the soaring tenor of Jimmy Lee, the finest singer in the village. The singing made him think of High Glen and the dream of freedom, and he steeled his nerve and resolved to go through with his plan. The pastor, Reverend John York, was a mild-mannered 40-year-old with thinning hair. He spoke hesitantly, unnerved by the magnificence of the visitors. His sermon was about truth. How would he react to Mac's reading out the letter? His instinct would be to take the side of the mine owner. He was probably going to dine at the castle after the service. But he was a clergyman. He would be obliged to speak out for justice, regardless of what Sir George might say, wouldn't he?
The plain stone walls of the church were bare. There was no fire, of course, and Mac's breath clouded in the cold air. He studied the castle folk. He recognized most of the Jamieson family. When Mac was a boy, they had spent much of their time here. Sir George was unmistakable, with his red face and fat belly. His wife was beside him, in a frilly pink dress that might have looked pretty on a younger woman. There was Robert, the elder son, hard-eyed and humorless, 26 years old and just beginning to develop the round-bellied look of his father. Next to him was a handsome, fair-haired man of about Mac's age. He had to be Jay, the younger son. The summer Mac was 6 years old, he had played with Jay every day in the woods around Castle Jamieson, and both had thought they would be friends for life. But that winter, Mac had started work in the pit, and then there was no more time for play. He recognized some of the Jamieson's guests. Lady Hallam and her daughter Lizzie were familiar. Lizzie Hallam had long been a source of sensation and scandal in the glen. People said she roamed around in men's clothing, with a gun over her shoulder. She would give her boots to a barefoot child, then berate its mother for not scrubbing her doorstep. Mac had not set eyes on her for years. The Hallam estate had its own church, so they did not come here every Sunday, but they visited when the Jamiesons were in residence, and Mac recalled seeing Lizzie on the last occasion, when she had been about 15, dressed as a fine lady, but throwing stones at squirrels just like a boy. Mac's mother had once been a lady's maid at Hyde Lane House, the Hallam mansion, and after she married, she had sometimes gone back on a Sunday afternoon to see her old friends and show off her twin babies. Mac and Esther had played with Lizzie on those visits, probably without the knowledge of Lady Hallam. Lizzie had been a little minx, bossy, selfish, and spoiled. Mac had kissed her once, and she had pulled his hair and made him cry. She looked as though she had not changed much. She had a small, impish face, curly, dark brown hair, and very dark eyes that suggested mischief. Her mouth was like a pink bow. Staring at her, Mac thought, I'd like to kiss her now. Just as the notion crossed his mind, she caught his eye. He looked away, embarrassed, as if she might have read his mind. The sermon came to an end. In addition to the usual Presbyterian service, there was to be a christening today. Mac's cousin, Jen, had given birth to her fourth child. Her eldest, Wally, was already working down the pit. Mac had decided that the most appropriate time for his announcement was during the christening. As the moment drew near, he felt a watery sensation in his stomach. Then he told himself not to be foolish. He risked his life every day down a mine. Why should he be nervous about defying a fat merchant? Jen stood at the font, looking weary. She was only 30, but she had borne 4 children and worked down the pit for 23 years, and she was worn out. Mr. York sprinkled water on her baby's head. Then her husband, Saul, repeated the form of words that made a slave of every Scottish miner's son. I pledge this child to work in Sir George Jamieson's mines, boy and man, for as long as he is able, or until he die. This was the moment Mac had decided on. He stood up. End of side one. Side 2. At this point in the ceremony, the viewer, Harry Ratchett, would normally step up to the font and hand over to Saul the arles, the traditional payment for pledging the child, a purse of £10. However, to Mac's surprise, Sir George rose to perform this ritual personally. As he stood up, he caught Mac's eye. For a moment, the two men stood staring at one another. Then Sir George began to walk to the font. Mac stepped into the central aisle of the little church and said loudly, "The payment of arles is meaningless." Sir George froze in mid-step, and all heads turned to look at Mac. There was a moment of shocked silence. Mac could hear his own heartbeat. "This ceremony has no force," Mac declared. "The boy may not be pledged to the mine. A child cannot be enslaved."
Sir George said, "Sit down, you young fool, and shut your mouth." The patronizing dismissal angered Mac so much that all his doubts vanished. "You sit down," he said recklessly, and the congregation gasped at his insolence. He pointed a finger at Mr. York. "You spoke about truth in your sermon, Pastor. Will you stand up for truth now?" The clergyman looked at Mac with a worried air.
"What is this all about, McCash?"
"Slavery."
"Now, you know the law of Scotland," York said in a reasonable tone. "Coal miners are the property of the mine owner. As soon as a man has worked a year and a day, he loses his freedom."
"Aye," Mac said, "it's wicked, but it's the law. I'm saying the law does not enslave children, and I can prove it."
Saul spoke up. "We need the money, Mac," he protested.
"Take the money," Mac said. "Your boy will work for Sir George until he's 21, and that's worth £10. But," he raised his voice, "but when he's of age, he will be free."
"I advise you to hold your tongue," Sir George said threateningly. "This is dangerous talk."
"It's true, though," Mac said stubbornly. Sir George flushed purple.
He was not used to being defied so persistently.
"I will deal with you when the service is over," he said angrily.
He handed the purse to Saul, then turned to the pastor. "Carry on, please, Mr. York." Mac was flummoxed. Surely they would not simply go on as if nothing had happened. The pastor said,
"Let us sing the final hymn."
Sir George returned to his seat. Mac remained standing, unable to believe it was all over. The pastor said,
"The second psalm, 'Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing?'"
A voice behind Mac said,
"No, no, not yet."
He looked around. It was Jimmy Lee, the young miner with the wonderful singing voice. He had run away once already, and as a punishment he wore around his neck an iron collar stamped with the words, "This man is the property of Sir George Jamieson of Fife, A.D. 1767.
"Thank God for Jimmy," Mac thought.
"You can't stop now," Jimmy said. "I'm 21 next week. If I'm going to be free, I want to know about it."
Ma Lee, Jimmy's mother, said,
"So do we all."
She was a tough old woman with no teeth, much respected in the village, and her opinion was influential. Several other men and women voiced agreement.
"You're not going to be free," Sir George rasped, standing up again.
Esther tugged at Mac's sleeve.
"The letter," she hissed urgently. "Show them the letter."
Mac had forgotten about it in his excitement.
"The law says differently, Sir George," he cried, waving the letter.
York said,
"What is that paper, McCash?"
"It's a letter from a London lawyer that I've consulted."
Sir George was so outraged, he looked as if he might burst. Mac was glad they were separated by rows of pews, otherwise the laird might have got him by the throat.
"You have consulted a lawyer?" he spluttered.
That seemed to offend him more than anything else. York said,
"What does the letter say?"
"I'll read it," Mac said. "The ceremony of Arles has no foundation in English or Scottish law."
There was a rumble of surprised comment from the congregation. This contradicted everything they had been taught to believe.
"The parents cannot sell what they do not own, namely the freedom of a grown man. They may compel their child to work in the mine until he reaches the age of 21, but..."
Mac paused dramatically and read the next bit very slowly.
"But then he will be free to leave."
All at once everyone wanted to say something. There was uproar as 100 people tried to speak, shout, begin a question, or voice an exclamation. Probably half the men in the church had been pledged as children and had always considered themselves slaves in consequence. Now they were being told they had been deceived, and they wanted to know the truth. Mac held up a hand for quiet, and almost immediately they fell silent. For an instant he marvelled at his power.
"Let me read one more line," he said. "Once the man is adult, the law applies to him as it applies to everyone else in Scotland. When he has worked a year and a day as an adult, he loses his freedom."
There were grunts of anger and disappointment. This was no revolution, the men realised. Most of them were no more free than they had ever been. But their sons might escape.
York said, "Let me see that letter, Macash."
Mac went up to the front and handed it to him. Sir George, still flushed with anger, said,
"Who is this so-called lawyer?"
Mac said, "His name is Caspar Gordonson."
York said, "Oh, yes, I've heard of him."
"So have I," said Sir George scornfully, "an out-and-out radical. He's an associate of John Wilkes."
Everyone knew the name of Wilkes. He was the celebrated liberal leader living in exile in Paris, but constantly threatening to return and undermine the government. Sir George went on,
"Gordonson will hang for this, if I have anything to do with it. That letter is treason."
The pastor was shocked at this talk of hanging.
"I hardly think treason comes into it."
"You'd better confine yourself to the kingdom of heaven," Sir George said sharply. "Leave it to men of this world to decide what is treason and what is not."
With that, he snatched the letter out of York's hand. The congregation were shocked at this brutal rebuke to their pastor, and they went quiet, waiting to see how he would react. York held Jamieson's gaze, and Mac was sure the pastor would defy the laird. But then York dropped his eyes, and Jamieson looked triumphant. He sat down again, as if it was all over. Mac was outraged by York's cowardice. The church was supposed to be the moral authority. A pastor who took orders from the laird was completely superfluous. Mac gave the man a look of frank contempt and said in a derisive voice,
"Are we to respect the law or not?"
Robert Jamieson stood up, flushed with anger like his father.
"You'll respect the law, and your laird will tell you what the law is," he said. "That's the same as having no law at all," Mac said. "Which is just as well as far as you're concerned," Robert said. "You're a coal miner. What have you to do with the law? As for writing to lawyers..."
He took the letter from his father.
"This is what I think of your lawyer."
He tore the paper in half. The miners gasped. Their future was written on those pages, and he was ripping them up. Robert tore the letter again and again, then threw the pieces in the air. They fluttered over Saul and Jen like confetti at a wedding. Mac felt as grief-stricken as if someone had died. The letter was the most important thing that had ever happened to him. He had planned to show it to everyone in the village. He had imagined taking it to other pits in other villages until all Scotland knew about it. Yet Robert had destroyed it in a second. Defeat must have shown in his face, for Robert looked triumphant. That enraged Mac. He would not be crushed so easily. Anger made him defiant. "I'm not finished yet," he thought. The letter had gone, but the law was still the same.
"I see you're frightened enough to destroy that letter," he said, and he was surprised by the withering scorn in his own voice. "But you can't tear up the law of the land. That's written on a paper that's not so easily ripped."
Robert was startled. He hesitated, not sure how to respond to such eloquence. After a moment, he said angrily,
"Get out!"
Mac looked at Mr. York, and the Jamiesons did the same.
No layman had the right to order a member of the congregation to leave a church. Would the pastor bow the knee and let the laird's son throw out one of his flock?
"Is this God's house or Sir George Jamieson's?" Mac demanded.
It was a decisive moment, and York was not equal to it. He looked shamefaced and said,
"You'd better leave, Macash."
Mac could not resist a retort, though he knew it was foolhardy.
"Thank you for the sermon on truth, Pastor," he said. "I'll never forget it."
He turned away. Esther stood up with him. As they started down the aisle, Jimmy Lee got up and followed. One or two others stood. Then Ma Lee got to her feet, and suddenly the exodus became general. There was a loud scraping of boots and rustling of dresses as the miners left their places, bringing their families with them. As Mac reached the door, he knew that every miner in the place was following him out of the church, and he was seized by a feeling of fellowship and triumph that brought tears to his eyes. They gathered around him in the churchyard. The wind had dropped, but it was snowing, big flakes drifting lazily down onto the gravestones.
"That was wrong, to tear up the letter,"
Jimmy said angrily. Several others agreed.
"We'll write again," said one.
Mac said, "It may not be so easy to get the letter posted a second time."
His mind was not really on these details.
He was breathing hard, and he felt exhausted and exhilarated, as if he had run up the side of Hyde Glen.
"The law is the law," said another miner. "Aye, but the laird is the laird," said a more cautious one.
As Mac calmed down, he began to wonder realistically what he had achieved. He had stirred everyone up, of course, but that on its own would not change anything. The Jamesons had flatly refused to acknowledge the law. If they stuck to their guns, what could the miners do? Was there ever any point in fighting for justice? Would it not be better to touch his forelock to the laird and hope one day to get Harry Ratchett's job as viewer? A small figure in black fur shot out of the church porch like a deerhound unleashed. It was Lizzie Hallam. She made straight for Mac. The miner stepped out of her way with alacrity. Mac stared at her. She had looked pretty enough in repose, but now that her face was alive with indignation, she was ravishing. Her black eyes flashing fire, she said,
"Who do you think you are?"
"I'm Malachy McCash."
"I know your name," she said. "How dare you talk to the laird and his son that way?"
"How dare they enslave us when the law says they may not?"
The miners murmured their agreement. Lizzie looked around at them. Snowflakes clung to the fur of her coat. One landed on her nose, and she brushed it off with an impatient gesture.
"You're fortunate to have paid work," she said. "You should all be grateful to Sir George for developing his mines and providing your families with the means to live."
Mac said,
"If we're so fortunate, why do they need laws forbidding us to leave the village and seek other work?"
"Because you're too foolish to know when you're well off."
Mac realized he was enjoying this contest, and not just because it involved looking at a beautiful, high-born woman. As an opponent, she was more subtle than either Sir George or Robert. He lowered his voice and adopted an inquiring tone.
"Miss Hallam, have you ever been down a coal mine?"
Ma Lee cackled with laughter at the thought. Lizzie said,
"Don't be ridiculous."
"If one day you do, I guarantee that you'll never again call us lucky."
"I've heard enough of your insolence," she said. "You should be flogged."
"I probably will be," he said,
but he did not believe it. No miner had been flogged here in his lifetime, though his father had seen it. Her chest was heaving. He had to make an effort not to look at her bosom. She said,
"You've an answer for everything you always had."
"Aye, but you've never listened to any of them."
He felt an elbow dig painfully into his side. It was Esther telling him to watch his step, reminding him that it never paid to outsmart the gentry. She said,
"We'll think about what you've told us, Miss Hallam, and thank you for your advice."
Lizzie nodded condescendingly.
"You're Esther, aren't you?"
"Aye, miss."
She turned to Mac.
"You should listen to your sister. She's got more sense than you."
"That's the first true thing you've said to me today." Esther hissed,
"Mac, shut your gob!"
Lizzie grinned, and suddenly all her arrogance vanished. The smile lit up her face, and she seemed another person, friendly and gay.
"I haven't heard that phrase for a long time," she laughed.
Mac could not help laughing with her. She turned away, still chuckling. Mac watched her walk back to the church porch and join the Jamesons, who were just emerging.
"My God,"
he said, shaking his head.
"What a woman."
Chapter 4. Jay was angered by the row in the church. It infuriated him to see people getting above their station. It was God's will and the law of the land that Malachy McCash should spend his life hewing coal underground, and Jay Jamieson should live a higher existence. To complain about the natural order was wicked, and McCash had an infuriating way of speaking, as if he was the equal of anyone, no matter how high-born. In the colonies now, a slave was a slave, and no nonsense about working a year and a day or being paid wages. That was the way to do things, in Jay's opinion. People would not work unless compelled to, and compulsion might as well be merciless. It was more efficient. As he left the church, some of the crofters offered congratulations on his 21st birthday, but not one of the miners spoke to him. They stood in a crowd to one side of the graveyard, arguing among themselves in low, angry voices. Jay was outraged by the blight they had cast on his celebratory day. He hurried through the snow to where a groom held the horses. Robert was already there, but Lizzie was not. Jay looked around for her. He had been looking forward to riding home with Lizzie.
"Where's Miss Elizabeth?" he said to the groom.
"Over by the porch, Mr. Jay."
Jay saw her talking animatedly to the pastor.
Robert tapped Jay on the chest with an aggressive finger. "Listen here, Jay. You leave Elizabeth Hallam alone. Do you understand?" Robert's face was set in belligerent lines. It was dangerous to cross him in this mood, but anger and disappointment gave Jay courage.
"What the devil are you talking about?" he said.
"You're not going to marry her. I am."
"I don't want to marry her."
"Then don't flirt with her." Jay knew that Lizzie had found him attractive, and he had enjoyed bantering with her, but he had no thought of capturing her heart. When he was 14 and she 13, he had thought she was the most beautiful girl in the world, and it had broken his heart that she was not interested in him, or indeed any other boy. But that was a long time ago. Father's plan was for Robert to marry Lizzie, and neither Jay nor anyone else in the family would oppose the wishes of Sir George. So Jay was surprised Robert had been upset enough to complain. It showed he was insecure, and Robert, like his father, was not often unsure of himself. Jay enjoyed the rare pleasure of seeing his brother worried.
"What are you afraid of?" he said.
"You know damn well what I mean. You've been stealing my things since we were boys. My toys, my clothes, everything." An old familiar resentment goaded Jay into saying, "Because you always got whatever you wanted and I got nothing." "Nonsense. Anyway, Miss Hallam is a guest at our house," Jay said in a more reasonable tone. "I can't ignore her, can I?" Robert's mouth set in a stubborn line. "Do you want me to speak to Father about it?" Those were the magic words that had ended so many childhood disputes. Both brothers knew that their father would always rule in favor of Robert. A long, familiar bitterness rose in Jay's throat. "All right, Robert," he conceded. "I'll try not to interfere with your courting." He swung onto his horse and trotted away, leaving Robert to escort Lizzie to the castle. Castle Jamieson was a dark grey stone fortress with turrets and a battlemented roof line, and it had the tall, overbearing look of so many Scottish country houses. It had been built 70 years ago, after the first coal pit in the glen began to bring wealth to the laird. Sir George inherited the estate through a cousin of his first wife. Throughout Jay's childhood, his father had been obsessed with coal. He had spent all his time and money opening new pits, and no improvements had been made to the castle. Although it was Jay's childhood home, he did not like the place. The huge, draughty rooms on the ground floor, hall, dining room, drawing room, kitchen and servants' hall, were arranged around a central courtyard with a fountain that was frozen from October to May. The place was impossible to heat. Fires in every bedroom, burning the plentiful coal from the Jamieson pits, made little impression on the chill air of the big flagstone chambers, and the corridors were so cold that you had to put on a cloak to go from one room to another. 10 years ago, the family had moved to London, leaving a skeleton staff to maintain the house and protect the game. For a while, they would come back every year, bringing guests and servants with them, renting horses and a carriage from Edinburgh, hiring crofters' wives to mop the stone floors and keep the fires alight and empty the chamber pots. But Father became more and more reluctant to leave his business, and the visits petered out. This year's revival of the old custom did not please Jay. However, the grown-up Lizzie Hallam was a pleasant surprise, and not merely because she gave him the means of tormenting his favoured older brother. He rode around to the stables and dismounted. He patted the gelding's neck. "He's no steeplechaser, but he's a well-behaved mount," he said to the groom, handing over the reins. "I'd be glad to have him in my regiment." The groom looked pleased.
"Thank you, sir," he said.
Jay went into the great hall. It was a big, gloomy chamber with dim, shadowy corners into which the candlelight hardly penetrated. A sullen deerhound lay on an old fur rug in front of the coal fire. Jay gave it a nudge with the toe of his boot and made it get out of the way so that he could warm his hands. Over the fireplace was the portrait of his father's first wife, Robert's mother, Olive. Jay hated that painting. There she was, solemn and saintly, looking down her long nose at all who came after her. When she caught a fever and died suddenly at the age of 29, his father had remarried, but he never forgot his first love. He treated Jay's mother, Alicia, like a mistress, a plaything with no status and no rights. And he made Jay feel almost like an illegitimate son. Robert was the firstborn, the heir, the special one. Jay sometimes wanted to ask whether it had been an immaculate conception and a virgin birth. He turned his back on the picture.
A footman brought him a goblet of hot mulled wine, and he sipped it gratefully. Perhaps it would settle the tension in his stomach. Today, Father would announce what Jay's portion would be. He knew he was not going to get half, or even a tenth, of his father's fortune. Robert would inherit this estate, with its rich mines, and the fleet of ships he already managed. Jay's mother had counseled him not to argue about that. She knew Father was implacable. Robert was not merely the only son. He was Father all over again. Jay was different, and that was why his father spurned him. Like Father, Robert was clever, heartless, and mean with money. Jay was easygoing and spendthrift. Father hated people who were careless with money, especially his money. More than once he had shouted at Jay, "I sweat blood to make money that you throw away." Jay had made matters worse just a few months ago by running up a huge gambling debt, £900. He had got his mother to ask Father to pay. It was a small fortune, enough to buy Castle Jamieson, but Sir George could easily afford it. All the same, he had acted as if he was losing a leg. Since then, Jay had lost more money, although Father did not know about that. "Don't fight your father," Mother reasoned, "but ask for something modest. Younger sons often went out to the colonies. There was a good chance his father would give him the sugar plantation in Barbados, with its estate house and African slaves." Both he and his mother had spoken to his father about it. Sir George had not said yes, but he had not said no, and Jay had high hopes. His father came in a few minutes later, stamping snow off his riding boots. A footman helped him off with his cloak.
"Send a message to Ratchet," the father said to the man. "I want two men guarding the bridge 24 hours a day. If McCash tries to leave the glen, they should seize him."
There was only one bridge across the river, but there was another way out of the glen. Jay said, "What if McCash goes over the mountain?"
"In this weather, he can try. As soon as we learn he's gone, we can send a party around by the road and have the sheriff and a squad of troops waiting on the other side by the time he gets there. But I doubt he'd ever make it."
Jay was not so sure. These miners were as hardy as the deer, and McCash was an obstinate wretch. But he did not argue with his father. Lady Hallam arrived next. She was dark-haired and dark-eyed, like her daughter, but she had none of Lizzie's spark and crackle. She was rather stout, and her fleshy face was marked with lines of disapproval. "Let me take your coat," Jay said, and helped her shrug off her heavy fur. "Come close to the fire. Your hands are cold. Would you like some mulled wine?"
"What a nice boy you are, Jay," she said. "I'd love some."
The other churchgoers came in, rubbing their hands for warmth and dripping melted snow on the stone floor. Robert was doggedly making small talk to Lizzie, going from one trivial topic to another as if he had a list. Father began to discuss business with Henry Drome, a Glasgow merchant who was a relation of his first wife, Olive, and Jay's mother spoke to Lady Hallam. The pastor and his wife had not come. Perhaps they were sulking about the row in the church. There was a handful of other guests, mostly relatives, Sir George's sister and her husband, Alicia's younger brother with his wife, and one or two neighbours. Most of the conversations were about Malachy McCash and his stupid letter. After a while, Lizzie's raised voice was heard over the buzz of conversation, and one by one people turned to listen to her.
"But why not?" she was saying. "I want to see for myself."
Robert said gravely, "A coal mine is no place for a lady, believe me."
"What's this?" Sir George said. "Does Miss Hallam want to go down a pit?"
"I believe I should know what it's like," Lizzie explained.
Robert said, "Apart from any other consideration, female clothing would make it almost impossible."
"Then I'll disguise myself as a man," she shot back.
Sir George chuckled.
"There are some girls I know who could manage that," he said, "but you, my dear, are much too pretty to get away with it."
He obviously thought this was a clever compliment and looked around for approval. The others laughed dutifully. Jay's mother nudged his father and said something in a low voice.
"Ah, yes," said Sir George. "Has everyone got a full cup?"
Without waiting for an answer, he went on, "Let us drink to my younger son, James Jamieson, known to us all as Jay, on his 21st birthday. To Jay." They drank the toast. Then the women retired to prepare for dinner. The talk among the men turned to business. Henry Drome said,
I don't like the news from America. It could cost us a lot of money.
Jay knew what the man was talking about. The English government had imposed taxes on various commodities imported into the American colonies, tea, paper, glass, lead, and painters' colours, and the colonists were outraged. Sir George said indignantly,
"They want the army to protect them from Frenchies and Redskins, but they don't want to pay for it."
"Nor will they, if they can help it," said Drome.
"The Boston town meeting has announced a boycott of all British imports. They're giving up tea, and they've even agreed to save on black cloth by skimping on mourning clothes."
Robert said, "If the other colonies follow the lead of Massachusetts, half our fleet of ships will have no cargoes." Sir George said,
"The colonists are a damned gang of bandits, that's all they are. And the Boston rum distillers are the worst."
Jay was surprised at how riled his father was. The problem had to be costing him money for him to get so worked up about it.
"The law obliges them to buy molasses from British plantations, but they smuggle in French molasses and drive the price down."
"The Virginians are worse," said Drome. "The tobacco planters never pay their debts."
"Don't I know it," said Sir George. "I've just had a planter default, leaving me with a bankrupt plantation on my hands, a place called Mock Jack Hall."
Robert said, "Thank God there's no import duty on convicts." There was a general murmur of agreement. The most profitable part of the Jameson shipping business was transporting convicted criminals to America. Every year the court sentenced several hundred people to transportation. It was an alternative to hanging as punishment for crimes such as stealing, and the government paid £5 per head to the shipper. 9 out of 10 transportees crossed the Atlantic on a Jameson vessel. But the government payment was not the only way money was made. On the other side, the convicts were obliged to do 7 years' unpaid labor, which meant they could be sold as 7-year slaves. Men fetched £10 to £15, women 8 or 9, children less. With 130 or 140 convicts packed into the hold shoulder to shoulder like fish in a basket, Robert could show a profit of £2,000, the purchase price of the ship, in a single voyage. It was a lucrative trade.
"Aye," said Father, and he drained his goblet. "But even that would stop if the colonists had their way."
End of side 2. Side 3. The colonists complained about it constantly. Although they continued to buy the convicts, such was the shortage of cheap labor out there, they resented the mother country dumping its riffraff on them and blamed the convicts for increasing crime.
"At least the coal mines are reliable," Sir George said. "They're the only thing we can count on these days. That's why McCash has to be crushed."
Everyone had opinions about McCash, and several different conversations broke out at once. Sir George seemed to have had enough of the subject, however. He turned to Robert. Adopting a jocular tone, he said,
"What about the Hallam girl, then, eh? A little jewel, if you ask me."
"Elizabeth is very spirited," Robert said dubiously.
"That's true," Father said with a laugh. "I remember when we shot the last wolf in this part of Scotland 8 or 10 years ago, and she insisted on raising the cubs herself. She used to walk around with 2 little wolves on a leash. You've never seen anything like it in your life. The gamekeepers were outraged, said the cubs would escape and become a menace, but they died, fortunately."
"She may make a troublesome wife," Robert said.
"Nothing like a mettlesome mare," Sir George said. "Besides, a husband always has the upper hand, no matter what. You could do a lot worse."
He lowered his voice.
"Lady Hallam holds the estate in trust until Elizabeth marries. Since a woman's property belongs to her husband, the whole place will become her bridegroom's on her wedding day."
"I know," Robert said.
Jay had not known, but he was not surprised. Few men would be happy to bequeath a sizable estate to a woman. Sir George went on, "There must be 1,000,000 tons of coal under Hyde Glen. All the seams run in that direction. The girl is sitting on a fortune. Pardon the vulgarity," he chortled. Robert was characteristically dour. "I'm not sure how much she likes me."
"What is there to dislike? You're young, you're going to be rich, and when I die you'll be a baronet. What more could a girl want?"
"Romance," Robert answered. He pronounced the word with distaste, as if it were an unfamiliar coin offered by a foreign merchant.
"Miss Hallam can't afford romance."
"I don't know," Robert said. "Lady Hallam has been living in debt since I can remember. Why should she not go on like that forever?"
"I'll tell you a secret," Sir George said.
He glanced over his shoulder to make sure he was not overheard.
"You know she has mortgaged the entire estate."
"Everyone knows that."
"I happen to know that her creditor is not willing to renew."
Robert said, "But surely she could raise the money from another lender and pay him off."
"Probably," Sir George said, "but she doesn't know it. And her financial adviser won't tell her. I've made sure of that."
Jay wondered what bribe or threat his father had used to suborn Lady Hallam's adviser. Sir George chuckled.
"So you see, Robert, young Elizabeth can't afford to turn you down."
At that moment, Henry Drome broke away from his conversation and came over to the three Jamieson men.
"Before we go into dinner, George, there's something I have to ask you. I may speak freely in front of your sons, I know."
"Of course. The American troubles have hit me quite hard. Planters who can't pay their debts and so on. And I fear I can't meet my obligations to you this quarter."
Sir George had obviously loaned money to Henry. Normally, father was brutally practical with debtors. They paid, or they went to jail. Now, however, he said,
"I understand, Henry. Times are hard. Pay me when you can."
Jay's jaw dropped, but a moment later he realized why his father was being so soft. Drome was a relative of Robert's mother, Olive, and father was being easy on Henry for her sake. Jay was so disgusted he walked away. The ladies came back. Jay's mother wore a suppressed smile, as if she had an amusing secret. Before he could ask her what it was, another guest arrived, a stranger in clerical grey. Alicia spoke to the man, then took him to Sir George.
"This is Mr. Cheshire," she said. "He's come in place of the pastor."
The newcomer was a pockmarked young man with spectacles and an old-fashioned curly wig. Although Sir George and the older men still wore wigs, younger men did so rarely, and Jay never did.
"The Reverend Mr. York sends his apologies," said Mr. Cheshire.
"Not at all, not at all," said Sir George, turning away.
He was not interested in obscure young clergymen. They went in to dinner. The smell of food mingled with the damp odour that came from the heavy old curtains. The long table was laid with an elaborate spread. Joints of venison, beef and ham, a whole roast salmon, and several different pies. But Jay could hardly eat. Would father give him the Barbados property? If not, what else? It was hard to sit still and eat venison when your entire future was about